Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. There's no denying that GOP operative Karl Rove is a brilliant spin doctor, but medical doctor? Does he really have the right to diagnose Hillary Clinton with brain damage? And while we're talking about damaged brains, should Donald Sterling be exempted from his racist remarks if it turns out he really has dementia? Join us on the line to talk about these and other medical ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art, as you know, is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. Also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Hello again, Art.
Hello, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Or good afternoon, I should say. Whoops. Anyway, glad you're here, Art Kaplan. So, Art, as soon as we heard this story about Karl Rove going to this conference and saying that Hillary Clinton, who had that blood clot after she fell down December 2012, that when she wore glasses that are only for people who have traumatic brain injury, and that's his quote, this he implied that she had brain damage. Jim and I said to ourselves, we need Art Kaplan to get to the bottom of this. And here you are. So what's the deal?
Well, the last time I saw those kind of glasses was on Harry Potter.
Exactly.
Magical glasses. I don't think there are any such glasses. I don't know why Dr. Rove is making these diagnoses from his distant perch, far away from where Ms. Clinton is. But it looks to me all politics, no medicine. And I don't think we should put up with it, actually. He should really be forced to walk all that back. It's just nonsense. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just playing a political game. In fact, I was thinking to myself, where was he when they were wheeling old Strom Thurmond in at 152 into the Senate to vote on things, who clearly was not with it?
Well, actually, where he was Strom's best man when he married a 23-year-old when he was 115. You know, but one thing that, and incidentally, in all fairness to Karl Rove, the next day he said, quote, of course she doesn't have brain damage. Now, he doesn't know that anymore than he knew whether she did. But the underlying issue, which is a serious issue, which I assume you've thought about from time to time, Art Kaplan, is how full and thorough should the disclosure of people, assuming she runs for president, be if someone wants to be leader of the free world, whether they're going to be 69 when she takes office, which she would be, or 49. Is that a debate anymore, or do most politicians acknowledge we've got to tell you virtually everything?
Well, they do acknowledge it, at least the ones running for the top office, president. We don't get it quite at the level of your congressman and so on. I do think it's still an issue, and I think the problem is twofold. One, you know, sort of what's the cutoff? I'd be willing to say, president, you're running for president, you're running for vice president, you probably ought to disclose all medical records. But what I'd really like to see is an independent evaluation by some appointed body of doctors so that it's not just your doctors saying this is what's wrong with you, because there's clearly a conflict of interest there. And in fact, it's hard to be your doctor if you're going to be telling the world what's wrong with you. So I would like to see, although it seems to come up every presidential election about the health of candidates, and we don't do it, but an independent board examining people for issues that might be relevant, let's say, to their ability to do the office.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, our favorite medical ethicist, our only medical ethicist.
I was just going to say, how many medical ethicists do you know, Marjorie?
He's the only one I know. Anyway.
I'll still take the favorite thing, though.
Well, you wrote a terrific piece about Michael Sam. He's, of course, the guy that was just drafted by the St. Louis Rams into the NFL, the only guy that announced publicly that he was gay before the draft. Your piece was about how Michael Sam would be treated in the NFL locker room. What'd you write?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of attention to how the NFL and its fans are going to receive this now publicly announced gay athlete. And there was a ton of attention to the fact that when he was drafted, they had cameras in there watching his reaction, and he kissed his boyfriend. So Michael Sam's kiss has became a huge issue, some people saying they turned him off, I didn't like it, others saying, you know, who cares? I was more in the who cares side of things. I'm not sure I need to see draftees smooching anybody, but all right.
But we have, I mean, in all fairness, and you know this, we've seen virtually every draftee crying and then smooching someone.
That's what I meant.
And heterosexually.
I'm not sure I care. I'm not too worried about who they're smooching. I'm not sure I need to see their little family response. But if people like that, and, you know, we're getting more mature about homosexuality, then, yeah, he's going to kiss his partner, and that's sort of how it is. But more to the point of Marjorie's question, to me, What I know about bullying and harassment in sports is it really matters as to what the leadership in the locker room does. It doesn't matter what the fans say. It doesn't matter what the media say. It doesn't matter what blogs say. It doesn't matter if people say, I'm uncomfortable about him kissing his partner. What's going to be important for him, and I think we'll set the tone then for the rest of professional football and ultimately all sports, will the leaders in the locker room, coaches, alumni who visit there, say in Boston, if some famous Patriots from the past drop by, what's Tom Brady going to do? Those are the guys who set the tone. And if they accept him and really say he's a brother, he's part of a team, we have each other's back, I think things will go just dandy for Michael Sam. That is, if he makes the team.
Right, of course. You quote in your piece Harry Carson, for those who don't remember, former linebacker for the Giants, Hall of Famer, former captain. He's speaking at your place at NYU, mm-hmm. New York University. Mm-hmm. What was the thrust of what Carson had to say, Art Kaplan?
Yeah, so we had Carson come in to talk a little bit about issues in professional football, and I got a chance to ask him about this, and he said, look, we had a guy in our locker room who everybody knew was gay, and this was, you know, 35 years ago. We didn't care. We just wanted to know if he could play the position. We had his back. We didn't say anything. We treated him as just as they would anybody else. And that's what a good leader does. So he basically said, we've already dealt with this. We didn't make a big deal about it. The person in question didn't come out at the time, but they knew. And so he basically said, what a leader does is make sure that everybody treats each other with respect. And I think that's the lesson, by the way, that even at the high school level, junior high school level, that's what we want to get into when we think about things like bullying. The leaders, coaches, captains, that group of people, they set the ethical tone. That's where we have to really expect them to say, look, it's a team, it's diverse, got a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of personalities. We're going to pull for one another, but we're not going to exclude or isolate anybody.
But is there a lesson that goes beyond the locker room, whether it's the New York Giants locker room or the St. Louis Rams with Michael Sam or that high school locker room you're talking about? Is there a transferable moral to this story that could be used in the non-locker room world?
I think it could be used in the workplace. I think it can be used at the country club. I think it could be used anywhere. And the lesson's pretty simple. It is, we treat each other with respect to get the job done that we need to get done. When you're a leader, you set the moral tone. People look to you. If you make fun of or bully or harass somebody, it's infectious. Other people are going to do it. When you say, not on my watch, we don't do that here. In pro sports, they say we check that right away, meaning they block it or stop it. Part of being a good leader, whether you're a CEO or somebody who's a leader in a hospital or a hospital administrator or an executive at a public radio station, is you set the tone. And that, I think, is the big – that's the lesson there. That's really how ethics works.
Let's say on sports-related things, we're going to play some sound from a couple of nights ago from Anderson Cooper's interview with the most hated man in America, I guess, Donald Sterling, soon to be, at least if the NBA has its way, the former owner – of the Los Angeles Clippers. Here are two sound bites of Sterling with Anderson Cooper glommed together. Please listen.
I'm a good member who made a mistake, and I'm apologizing, and I'm asking for forgiveness. Am I entitled to one mistake? Am I, after 35 years, everybody wants to be cared for. I made such a mistake. I thought that woman really cared for me.
You know, when you watch both pieces there, you first see a guy trying to apologize. You then, of course, we didn't play what everybody's been talking about, his disparagement of Magic Johnson. It's sort of like, by the way, I'm not a racist, but let me talk about a black guy who really is contemptuous, who's done great things, even though I'm denying them, for other African-Americans. And then he does this, I thought, quite sad thing about an old guy wanting to be loved, wanting to be cared for. So when you watch this, do you see a racist or do you see a guy with dementia or both? How do you view Donald Sterling, Art Kaplan?
By the way, that's what his wife says.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
She thinks he does have dementia.
I don't know. I'm not going to do that Karl Rove thing and say from where I sit he's not. Yeah. But I do say this. Until proven that he's not competent. And by the way, I feel this way about Oscar Pistorius, who these days is showing up in court saying, maybe I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Just got introduced into his trial after the killing of his girlfriend. Until proven otherwise, you presume competent. And so I'm going to take him at face value, and I think he is a racist. By the way, I think he's a racist for some other remarks he said. You remember his comments about what Jews do and how they rally around one another and take care of one another? You know, that was positive, but it's still stereotyping a group. I think this guy's, at his core, a racist. And until somebody shows me, you know, he's got degenerative brain disease or something's wrong in terms of Alzheimer's or something like that, I take him at his word. The NBA took him at his word. They didn't throw him out for being incompetent, you know, prior to all this.
Yeah.
So sadly, I think we got just a evil guy.
Well, let's fast forward for a second and do a generic Donald Sterling. And in a month, there is a diagnosis from a credible source that the guy does have early onset dementia or some such thing. My sense is that we are still in a state in this country where we are totally intolerant of and not understanding of people who have mental illness or those sort of things, meaning even if it could be attributed, and I have no idea either, obviously, if you don't, I particularly don't, if that's where all this came from, we don't forgive behavior, whether it's a crime or a racist remark or anything in this country, even if it's demonstrated conclusively that it's born of mental illness, not born of hate or criminality. That's a fair statement, isn't it?
I think that's true, although there's something else, Jim. This guy's got a history.
Oh, I know.
He's got
that,
a public record, and he didn't sort of turn into a racist, you know, last month.
Right. That's why I tried to take it away, Art, from Sterling, because we all know about the housing discrimination lawsuits.
Right,
but I mean,
exactly.
In general, as I say, the generic lowercase Donald Sterling, we're never forgiving of anybody. We are, of course, not. If someone commits
with mental illness,
if someone commits a crime, how about the kid who was the killer? I'm not saying you should forgive the kid, the killer who had Asperger's, and he's probably.
Oh, you mean in Newtown?
Yeah. No.
Well,
there's a guy also
too,
in Massachusetts who killed his girlfriend.
Young man in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Who killed another child in the bathroom at a school. That's what happened.
But there seems to me to be a complete lack of acceptance, even if a panel of doctors and ethicists said this guy knew not what he did, whoever he or she
is.
Yeah,
I agree.
No?
Yeah, I do. And I think you're right. I think popular opinion still says you do evil acts or you make evil remarks, these are still going to be evil inherently, and we're sorry if they issued from a, you know, impaired or damaged mental state. I think that's true. The law doesn't do it. The law can be more forgiving, and in that way we've gotten a little bit more humane about things when you do something because you simply are not able to be competent in any way. But morally, I think you're right. I think you still tend to condemn the content or condemn the behavior, and we're less interested in where it came from. Now, maybe that's poor and intolerant on our part in terms of the response to mental illness. But I think what we're trying to say is we have nothing to do with the merit of the message and probably just mix the two up. So hard to distinguish them, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
the source and the content.
To both of you, I've often thought if more juries were allowed to find someone guilty but insane, you'd
which
solve,
some states have, by the way.
Exactly. You'd solve a big problem because I think people don't want to find you not guilty by reason of insanity because they're afraid you'll be out of jail in a year or 2 years.
So Marjorie, this ties up to a little futuristic thing, but you know, we're doing more brain scans and we're learning more about the brain and what's abnormal and what's going on in there and so forth. I think we are going to move in your direction. That is to say, I think we're going to see more bad behavior coming from damaged brains, coming from, you know, you can demonstrate in a courtroom through pictures and images and scans that this person's got something wrong with them. And I think that'll shift us away from the punishment and more toward the therapy. Not tomorrow morning, but it's coming.
Yeah. Well, I think that would be a good thing because I think people do have empathy for mental illness. But anyway, not enough. But in any case, let's move on to Ritalin. Maybe this is why people have problems later in life, because when they were in college, they were not just doing the no-dos of that many of us did decades ago or drinking espresso. But now, apparently, lots of kids, according to this Washington Post piece, are using misusing, I should say, Ritalin. They're using Ritalin to keep them awake during exam times. Exam times are just over the last few days, and apparently thousands of kids all across America were misusing this drug. But the premise of this piece is that it's okay to keep yourself up all night with Red Bull or no-dos or cafe lattes, but it's wrong to use Ritalin because that's a crime.
No, wrong's not strong enough. Cheating. You are cheating if you do Ritalin because it's illegal. You obtained it illegally, but you're not cheating if you did no-dos.
Yeah.
And that's out of the Children's Medical Center in your town of mm-hmm. New York.
So what do you think about that?
So I'm tough on this one, and I'm really mad at our colleges and universities, and by the way, high schools. This isn't just a college problem. They got codes of conduct. They have honor codes. They lay out what cheating is. They say if you plagiarize, you know, copy from somebody else or copy from stuff on the internet and so forth or out of the library, that's cheating. They haven't set any standards out. What's the biggest drug problem in the United States today? Either of you know?
Nope. I don't.
Prescription drug abuse.
Yeah.
When you start in high school and you think, oh, you know, I could do this. I'll borrow mom's Ritalin or steal it out of the medicine cabinet or swap it off with somebody who's got it as a prescription. That's where a lot of that behavior starts. It leads to all kinds of trouble later in terms of nasty side effects and drug abuse and so forth. So I do think it ought to be seen as a form of cheating. I do think we ought to discourage it. Now, all you college and high school kids are now doubled over in laughter. I didn't say you could always enforce it, but you at least could take a stand and say, don't use illegal drugs. When you stay up all night swallowing Red Bull, that's not good for you. We as a college or a high school don't want you to do that. And I'm not even sure that really leads to the best test performance, but let's put that on the side. But my point is this. Set out your standards, try to promote health, try to get kids not to go, you know, lose it when they're facing exams, doing anything and everything they can to succeed. I don't think that's the right position. But as far as I can tell, no college, university, or high school that I've seen has any comment about this rampant drug abuse. I mean, they don't have it in their honor code. They don't have any statements about it.
You know what I thought was one of the interesting things in this story, too, is that they said that there's a certain kind of kid that winds up using or misusing, I should say, prescription drugs. It's the kids that play varsity sports and belong to fraternities or sororities. Right. So I don't know what to make of that.
Hey,
well,
Art,
you know,
did you take...
There's drug culture there, too. There's drug culture there, too, in terms of, you know, steroids and other things. So maybe sliding off of that way. We have alcohol abuse there. I think I'm getting into an episode of Reefer Madness here, but I don't know what's a gateway to what, but at least culturally, you don't want to support doing what it takes, so to speak, to do well, because I don't think you do well by taking anything, and I don't think that's the right position to have in your educational environment.
Well, I tend to agree with that, but that really, it seems to me that really isn't the question. The question is, while it is illegal to use a prescription drug that was not prescribed for you, and maybe there should be some sanction there, it seems to me to be beyond arbitrary that a school would determine that if you use no-dos like Marjorie and I did, or Red Bull didn't exist when we were in college, that's okay.
I knew, but you guys were cheaters.
But a prescription drug from your roommate,
well, because it's not
is
illegal.
Not okay.
That's what they're saying in this story. They're saying,
but
the
why is that cheating?
Is,
what's the relevance to the cheating issue?
Because you can go to CVS and buy a legal no-dos,
yeah.
And this is an illegal drug.
I understand the concept.
A use of
I just
drug,
don't buy.
I
just don't buy it. I mean,
yeah.
I buy the notion that prescription drug abuse is a real serious problem. I just don't see the way to enforce that or deal with that problem is through cheating allegations against somebody who takes it. So I guess.
Well, I'm not sure I care whether it's cheating or whether it's health. My point is, say something about it. Let's get a little more sane about how we treat the whole environment. I'm not, you know, if we could get people to not take somebody else's Ritalin by saying, that's not the right thing to do. It's not the healthy thing to do. We don't want you to do
I
that.
Agree
at
with
least
that.
Say that.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree with that. Okay.
Of course, they never listen, do they?
What's that?
They
no,
never
that's
listen,
why
do
I said they were laughing while I was talking. I heard it. I heard
exactly.
The laugh.
They're actually calling in as we speak. Last thing here, we've discussed Fed Up with virtually every guest we've had this week. And Fed Up, obviously, is the new movie, the Laurie David, Katie Couric, and I can't think of the woman who's the third woman involved in this. Focus. I mean, it's essentially the title we've given is Sugar Kills. It's about obesity in America, particularly childhood obesity. And all of us grew up, for those of us who have been dieting off and on our whole lives, this is me, not Marjorie, it's always been all calories are created equal. Is the message of Fed Up that all calories are not created equal, and should that be one that we take seriously in terms of our health and our fitness and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't think all calories are different. I think calorie is a calorie, so whether it comes from sugar or carbohydrates or chewing on cardboard, whatever the caloric value is of the thing, and I said chewing on cardboard because that's my attitude about a lot of the diet stuff that I've tried to eat.
By the way, after I took Nodos, I would eat cardboard, by the way. It was fairly regular, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
So what I think the message may be is that there's a lot of hidden calories out there. There's corn syrup and other sugary additives and products in almost, you know, from ketchup to who knows what. There's places you don't know that they're putting in a lot of sugar. I don't think the proper message is that there are certainly evil, bad calories and better calories. You know, at the end of the day, your body doesn't care where they came from. It just cares how many you ate. So that's the key to obesity reduction. But you do need to be alert. And I think the message is partly there, that there's a lot of hidden calories. That's probably what they're getting at.
But isn't part of the thing that if you have a comparable number of calories from something that's healthy, I don't know, nuts, yep, vegetables, those sort of things, have the same amount of calories from sugar, the nut and vegetable calories don't lead you to go back for more. But the sugar calories have a certain addiction thing, and they do cause you to go back for more.
They're more filling.
What's that? Well, whatever the filling. Well, exactly. So it's addiction. It's satisfaction. That part is true, isn't it, or is it?
Yeah, no. There's truth in that, and it is true that, you know, certain calories are a lot more nutritional than nuts, than just eating my favorite candy bars or something. So that's all true. But at the end of the day, you still can't go out and eat. You know, I've seen people say, "Well, I'm on a diet. I'm going to go with cereal in the morning. No more of those donuts. I'll just have my six bowls of cereal before I get going here." And it's sort of like, "Well, I don't know. Even if it's muesli or something healthy, it's still you can't eat six bowls of it." So that's my only point. But yes, you're absolutely right. So some foods fill you up more. Some foods leave you with a longing. I think you can get addicted to the sugar high. I get all that. I just want people to understand, at the end of the day, you don't need the diet book. You don't need all that. You just got to eat less calories.
Hey, by the way, before you go away, I want you to know about a week ago, I forgot to mention last week, I saw you on CNN with our former colleague, whom we love, Michael Smirkanish.
That was Donald Sterling. Oh, that was Donald Sterling.
Oh, of course.
Michael Smirkanish is
not
great.
Only did you look great, you sounded great, Art Kaplan, so I didn't want another week to pass telling you.
You want to tell him again how great a story was about Michael Sam?
What's that?
Want to tell him again?
It was great. It was a great piece.
Okay.
Hey, Art.
That's why I may be the only medical ethicist you know, but still the favorite.
Exactly. Hey, Art, good to speak to you.
That's right. Art Kaplan, thank you very much for talking with us today. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Up next, we continue our round of gubernatorial candidate interviews with Democrat Don Berwick. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.